started. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, thank you so much for your grandeur and your beauty. Thank you for the beautiful things that we get to experience in this life. We live in a fallen, broken world, and we talk about that, and we should talk about that, and we are aware of that, and we should be aware of that. And yet, through your common grace and through your special grace, we have the beautiful medium that is story. And we have the beautiful ideals that are set in reality that there is good, there is bad. We can fight against the badness because we know that the goodness will ultimately prevail. Thank you for your Son. I pray that he would be glorified. I pray that we would learn from the minds of the past. In your name, amen. All right, so what you have in front of you is a pink or white page of C.S. Lewis quotes. I will just refer to this periodically, and we'll throw this back up on the internet. If you didn't get an email with the documents last week, or if you just didn't get the documents last week, you can always go online to our website, and we do have a website, and under Sunday School there is a recording of the audio, and there's also some documents that you can download there in PDF form, and it's everything that we'll go through. So this week we left off C.S. Lewis in our narrative of his life. Again, if you follow the syllabus, we are looking mainly at his life up to the point of his death. And the last week, we looked at his sort of birth to right before he encounters God in an intimate and real way in his conversion. And if you remember from last week, there's a couple of things that C.S. Lewis writes about, specifically in Surprised by Joy, and his biographers notice about him, is that he has these desires, and he wants to experience joy in a way that he has experienced periodically throughout his life. When he was younger, he had these experiences of joy, and he had these experiences of not just happiness, but of fulfillment, of seeing the world in his imagination, and yet they were grounded in imaginative things. Let's talk about the difference. Imagination is, I can imagine something like a unicorn. A unicorn is not a real thing, but I can imagine that. I can imagine what it would look like. Movies are full of imaginations. Imaginative is using our imagination but it's grounded in something that's real. In other words, a unicorn looks like what? It looks like and a horse is real, right? So there is a distinction between imagination and imaginative. That's an important distinction to C.S. Lewis, because as we see in the future here, he is going to have a world of imagination, but it's grounded in the imaginative and what is real. And that was his pursuit for his life, is to find out what is real. How can I know what is real? Now, we talked last week about the triad of philosophy, and we're going to have to talk about that a little bit more because it's going to lead us into his conversion experiences. The triad would be epistemology, which is how do we know what we know? It's a theory of knowledge. Metaphysics, which is what is it to be something, or we talk about ontology. What is it to be human? What is it to be real? What is it to be anything? And then there is ethics. What is right and wrong? How do we know these things? And they're all tied to each other. What is it to be right and wrong? That's the metaphysical use of ethics. How do we know what is right and wrong? That's the epistemological view. And you can't escape epistemology and metaphysics from the ethical as well. They're a triad, and they all work in conjunction with another. And C.S. Lewis, up until this point, this is a bit of a review, but up until this point, his philosophy of life, or his philosophical understanding, his education, had been built around certain premises. And so metaphysically and ethically and epistemologically, he had grown up, in a sense, with a godless philosophy. God had no encounter in his philosophy. And that's an important point to understand. Specifically, we talked, I butchered it last week, but whatever. I talked about Hegelianism. I used James and I were talking about an example of Hegelian thought. I want to talk a little bit more about that because philosophy is one of the things that sort of got C.S. Lewis up the mountaintop. And then what carried him further along the mountaintop of imagination, of the imaginative, was literature. And we're going to talk a lot about literature today, particularly influences of guys like Tolkien and Owen Barfield and Charles Williams. But first, we need to just remember why his philosophy left him bankrupt with this concept of joy. All right, so philosophically speaking, there has always been an attempt in the minds of mankind to disregard God ever since what's called the fall. But specifically, we see it in things like the Tower of Babel, right? We will create this thing to go find out what is real instead of depending on God to tell us what is real. The Tower of Babel is a wonderful story that illustrates that point. In C.S. Lewis's world, there was a man who influenced a number of the thinkers he paid attention to up until this point. An example of that kind of person, or that kind of thinker, would be the Marquis de Sade. The Marquis de Sade was a philosopher somewhere around the 17th century, or maybe the 18th century. I don't know. Do you know? 17th century. somewhere around there. And the Marquis de Sade basically took a humanist philosophy and he said, God is something that is trumped up by our culture. Morality is God is something that is trumped up. We can't really know anything. We can't really know who God is. There might not even be a God. And therefore, we can't really know what is true epistemologically, ethically. And therefore, whatever we want to be is what we want. We should follow our deepest intuitions metaphysically. So, for example, the Marquis de Sade he wrote a ton of literature. He influenced a lot of people, but he basically operated. He was one of the first big authors in the last 2,000 years to operate within a world where God just didn't exist. He was a total social construct to keep people from acting out their greatest, deepest intuitions. The Marquis de Sade did terrible things. That's where we get sadism from, that word. That's where we get it from, is the Marquis de Sade. And the Marquis de Sade continually influenced people. Actually, side note, the Marquis de Sade became very, very popular among college campuses in the 70s and the 80s. That's shocking, I know. He still is very popular. That guy has resurfaced. The Marquis de Sade lived within this godless philosophy. Eventually, guys like Immanuel Kant, guys like George Hegel, and you can follow the philosophical trail down, all sort of lived within this, we can't really know who God is epistemologically. Ontologically or metaphysically, we're going to separate what's called the noumenal and the phenomenal. I don't want to get into all that stuff. And ethically, we're going to be confused. That's sort of the philosophy of which has shaped our modern world. And by the way, anybody who thinks that like that, like we can't really know what's real, what's good is for you is good for you, what's good is for me is good for me, like as long as that has actually been shaped by philosophers. That is the work, that is the street level of the academic, what's the word I'm looking for? Ivory tower. That is not like, you're talking to somebody who thinks that way, they didn't think of that by themselves. They have been trained that way. That is the water that the fish is swimming in. You know what water? Like that's the way that we've been living in, and that's how C.S. Lewis was living in his life. What it can't answer is that you have these desires. You have these desires specifically for C.S. Lewis for joy. You have a desire for good, even though you don't do it all the time. You have a desire for something more, for something greater, for something that is more meaningful. And that's what C.S. Lewis had to wrestle with. He continually wrestled with it. He continually fought against it. Yet, in the year of 1929, all of a sudden, through a couple different experiences. One of them is that his father had actually died. We left off C.S. Lewis. He became a professor at the Magdalene. I don't know how to say this right. Is it Madeline? Madeline. You don't say the G. You guys know more than I do. Madeline. Madeline College. There you go. A philosophy, and he's teaching this philosophy, this godless philosophy, of which he's starting to find it bankrupt for him personally. And so he sort of starts to explore things, and all of a sudden, through a number of writings of people writing things, which I will just say this, never discount the power of reading literature. I know that sometimes we may say, here's a book, and to our maybe even our young people, or if you're struggling with matters of faith or doubt, and we kind of hope that it works, but really we're waiting for that really big experience to come along, like that camp to change a teenager, or that catastrophic life event to change the heart of somebody that we really love. Those things sometimes draw people to God, but oftentimes it's actually through a slow movement. And for C.S. Lewis, it was a slow movement of reading things. So I would encourage you, if you have that wayward son or daughter or spouse or grandparent or whatever, that person that, man, I just want them to come. It may not happen in a flash. It may be a slow movement toward God. Well, that's what it was for C.S. Lewis. And so we see if you look on your list here, in 1929, Lewis, all of a sudden, because his intellectual doubt was eating at him so much of his philosophy, he all of a sudden, he reads guys like G.K. Chesterton, if you've ever read him. He read guys like George MacDonald. And these men were Christians, and he's sort of battles, and all of a sudden he becomes a theist, not a Christian, but he becomes intellectually privy to the idea that God could exist, and that's in 1929. And actually, there's a quote about his conversion. If you look at it, The Weight of Glory, first of all, it shows his sort of motivation toward. The first quote there, it says this. He says, the books of which he was fascinated with, remember, he was a philosophy student, but he started to get really into literature, and the music that he was really into when he was younger, specifically the music of Norse mythology, which we thought the beauty was located. The beauty is the thing that he's looking at, his desires, right? Remember? Will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them. In other words, it wasn't in the stories he was attracted to as a kid. It wasn't in the music that he was distracted to. It only came through them. The answer to ultimate things. And what came through them was longing. Longing. Nothing could satisfy C.S. Lewis. His own philosophy couldn't satisfy him. There were longings that he had. Perhaps in your life, maybe that's your story. I tried everything and it didn't work. It wasn't giving me fulfillment. It provided me with no joy. Well, that was C.S. Lewis here. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols. I love that line. Breaking the hearts of their worshipers. I don't know if that's been true of you, but I hope it has been if you've been chasing after those things as idols. They are dumb and they break your heart. The gods are cruel, right? Except for the God. And that's what he says. He says, for they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. And so what you see what's happening here in 1929, C.S. Lewis is coming to reconcile his desires for something greater than his own philosophy would give him. And by the way, his own philosophy allowed him to do some really wild things. He would get drunk at parties, and he would sort of chase after his relationship with Mrs. Moore that we had talked about last week was wild, if not inappropriate at best. I mean, it was different, but these things weren't satisfying his soul, right? To focus on this quote real quick, I know I'm jumping around a lot. It says, they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found. Think about that imagery for a second. When you walk downtown San Francisco, I would never suggest it, but if you do, there is a thing called Ghirardelli Square. And at Ghirardelli Square, they make Ghirardelli chocolate. And you're walking, and it's a total tourist trap, but you're walking down Pier 39 and you see the Alcatraz and all the people taking pictures and stuff. And you're walking down there, and all of a sudden you sort of get to the end of that section and you take a left, and you guess what you smell? Chocolate, right? And they know what they're doing. And so everybody goes in there and pays $12 for a little ice cream cone of chocolate, but ice cream. But whatever the case is, it's that smell that like entices us. I don't know what your experience has been like coming to know the Lord, but there is a fulfilled desire when we turn to Him, isn't there? There is this sense of, oh, this is reminding me of the good thing and I want more, right? And so you walk into Ghirardelli and you pay whatever they want you to pay for the thing. Or maybe you walk to God and you say, oh, yes, this is what I want. This is enticing me. There is an attractional thing to God's glory, especially for those who are seeking it. And that was C.S. Lewis. Another quote, if we find ourselves with the desire, again, that word pops up for him, a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. You can see his train of thought here. And then all of a sudden he says, atheism turns out to be too simple. If the universe has no meaning, we should never have found that it has no meaning. He's using his philosophical, logical mind to climb the mountain, and all of a sudden he's saying, this is not good. And he's seeing these stories saying, are they the ones that give us purpose and meaning? No, they're not. They just point to something. It's a marker in the road that's pointing to something greater. And then he says, at the bottom, I'm sorry I didn't put these quotes in great order, but at the bottom, the big quote there, he says this, in the year of 1929, this is in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, he says, you must picture me alone in that room in Madeline, night after night, feeling whatever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, this steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. You see, I did not see then what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son at least, walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore the love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance to escape? Just a quick note. My father grew up in Los Angeles, and he grew up nominally Catholic at best. My grandfather was my grandfather had a very prominent job in Hollywood among the Screen Actors Guild. He's the Workers' Rep Union. He's the head of the workers union. And so my dad sort of started to go into show business. He worked on an old movie, some weird movie called Planet of the Apes, and MASH. And Wonder Woman, he shined the light on her nose. I'm like, that's a great job. So it was a good job for an 18-year-old guy. But He was 18, and he and his best friend randomly, without really any prompting, walked into an old Baptist church, sat in the very back pew on a Sunday morning after they'd been out all night, and or at least out the night before. And him and his best friend kind of sat there, and this guy preached the gospel, and they sort of left right away. Talk about darting eyes, looking to escape. And they went back in the car, and they both looked at each other, and they're like, that was, I think I'm a Christian. And so when I think of this, I think of my dad, struggling, resentful, darting his eyes in every direction for a chance to escape. There's a French word here that didn't translate well. The words compel, does anybody know what that means? Compel to enter. Compel them to come in. Have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. But properly understood, they plumb the depth of his divine mercy, of the divine mercy. And this is just the one that you can take home and live off of this week. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men. And his compulsion is our liberation. And so all of a sudden, C.S. Lewis, our dejected and screaming convert, sitting in the back row of the church, not wanting to hear anything about the gospel, but all of a sudden has this moment where he says, God is God, and I'm going to sit down and pray. And that's the moment where C.S. Lewis starts to change, and yet he did not become a Christian. He only became a theist. It wasn't until a couple of years later when he started to, as he was interacting with a bunch of people at Magdalen College, that he became a Christian. And on that night, in 1931, you see there, Lewis becomes a Christian, and this is how the story goes, if you're not familiar with it. He's having continual conversations with Owen Barfield. Owen Barfield is a fine thinker. I wouldn't suggest reading him. He's actually pretty heretical. But he's a good thinker, and I think he might have been a Christian, I think. But he's definitely a theist and liked Christianity. And so he starts talking to Lewis quite a bit about Jesus Christ. Lewis said Owen Barfield was his arch nemesis and greatest friend because he always thought differently than Lewis. And so he had this friend that would always continually push against what he said. Again, an encouragement for you who have people that you love who don't know Jesus yet. Maybe it's not you. Maybe that's not your role in that person's life. But I would encourage you to pray that they would find somebody who would argue against them. Somebody who would talk to them continually about their doubts and to push on them. That was God's role for Owen Barfield in C.S. Lewis's life. And Owen Barfield did that, and then he brought another friend into the picture called J.R.R. Tolkien. Tolkien was also a professor of literature. They shared some same loves, and what Tolkien did and another friend, they stayed with him one night, and they started talking to him, arguing with him about Christianity, not just theism. C.S. Lewis is a theist, but a Christian. A guy named Hugo Dyson, and they stayed until, I think Tolkien stayed until about 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. Dyson stayed about 3 or 4 a.m, sitting there smoking their pipes, very erudite, you know, and talking about things that are intelligent. And Tolkien kept pushing Jesus Christ. The next day, him and Warney, C.S. Lewis and Warney, his brother, are on a drive to, I think, the zoo. And he said, by the time I left, when I left for the zoo, I was not a Christian. By the time I got back, I was. And that's what it was for him. No big moment, no rally, no Billy Graham crusade, saying, put your stick in the fire or throw the pine cone in the pile if you want to become a Christian, you know, walk down the aisle. It wasn't like that for C.S. Lewis. Most likely, it probably won't be like that for many people. There was just sort of this slow intellectual heart movement toward Christianity. And so C.S. Lewis becomes a Christian. And after that, C.S. Lewis becomes one of the most influential Christians in the last 100 years. Now he continues to write. Just a couple of highlights here from the dates. Oh, by the way, before I get into that, this joy that comes upon him. Joy does come upon him. Again, separate joy from happiness. C.S. Lewis's entire philosophical structure becomes reoriented. And now it's a God-filled philosophy. And it becomes a Christ-filled philosophy. And actually, if C.S. Lewis didn't have those tools of philosophy and understanding of literature, I don't think he would have been as good of a writer and as good of a thinker and as good of a storyteller as he was. In God's sovereignty, we can look back on his life and say, God gave you those tools of understanding, those tools of discernment, those academic proclivities to use to Christianity. That's a beautiful picture, I think, of how God can use things that people think are just for themselves and turn them for his glory. And so he starts to put to work his mind, his brilliant mind, and he starts to surround himself with a community of people. Perhaps you've heard of the Inklings. In 1933, you'll see that. He starts to meet with the number. He's actually already been meeting with these people, but he starts to meet for the next 16 to 20 years with a number of people who spur him on. People like Tolkien and Owen Barfield and Warney, Charles Williams, Dr. Robert Havard, and Neville Coghill. These are all people that push him toward what he's using his mind in these ways. In 1935, this is important, he actually starts to write the 16th century English literature for the Oxford History of English Literature series. It's published in 1954. That is still the industry standard for literature of the 16th century. If the expert in the world right now for English literature is C.S. Lewis still. That is still what... he is still considered the expert. I believe, Lloyd, you have that book, right? It's usually called the Oh Hell book. Yeah, it's up in your office. You showed it to me. That was pretty cool. I don't know if it's out of print, but I know major academic universities have it. It's still considered a major academic work. So that's that sets him apart academically. He becomes renowned in his own profession for this great work that he does. He starts writing stories, including the Space Trilogy there. There's an outbreak of World War II, which is important specifically for his writings because he starts to write a number of speeches and starts to give a number of addresses over the radio. And those number of addresses, they were about 15 minutes each. They were in a series of three lectures with 15-minute increments of each lecture, and they start to be compiled. They eventually become compiled, and does anybody know what that eventually becomes? Mere Christianity, one of his most famous sort of apologetical works of literary works, probably one of his most famous books, of defending the Christian faith and giving England through this terrible time of being bombed by the Germans and sending their loved ones off to die in the trenches of or in the battlefields of World War II, he starts to defend the faith. People start to lose faith in these things, and he wants to defend it and talk about, lead people to Jesus even in this time of crisis. I will just say this. Let's go back to the philosophical thing here. This is how God's sovereignty works. It's beautiful. If anybody knows about Germany, I grew up in Germany, in the 1930s and 20s, they'll know the name Adolf Hitler, of course. And Adolf Hitler was incredibly influenced by a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche was incredibly influenced by the Marquis de Sade and Hegel. Friedrich Nietzsche wrote a number of things, but one of his most famous works described was Zarathustra, which is this telling of kind of a poem story of this that the famous phrase in it is, of course, God is dead. What he meant by that was the need for God is dead. All right, that's what he meant by that. And one of the biggest disciples of Nietzsche was Adolf Hitler. And what Nietzsche said is the only thing that is real is basically your will. The greatest thing that you can do whatever is best for you, is to get your way. Now, I'm summarizing Nietzsche. Some of you are like, that's not what Nietzsche all said. And I'm like, okay, fine. But that is the major point that I want to bring out about Nietzsche, right? Hitler took that and said, the greatest thing that the German people have is what? Blood and soil. Expand Germany, proliferate the Aryan race. Right? That was the marching theme of the 20s and 30s from Hitler, blood and soil. He took that directly from Nietzsche. C.S. Lewis is coming along, and he's talking to a people who are in the midst of fighting a nation who believes in a godless philosophy and who is chasing after Nietzschean theories, even if they didn't fully recognize it. That is the air that they breathe. And now C.S. Lewis, in God's Sovereignty, who understood philosophy, who understood that philosophy, is now going to write a work that combats that and that encourages the people of England and London as they're sitting there experiencing the bombings and as they're sitting there experiencing their sons going off and dying in France and experiencing all these things. He's actually going to write to that. He's actually going to speak to them and write to them and say, no, God is good. There is a reason for these things. This is a beautiful thing. This is mere Christianity. This is why we are. This is why God is good. Why He is there. I think that's a beautiful picture of how God uses this guy to combat this philosophical outlook. Now, again, C.S. Lewis becomes widely famous through Mere Christianity. We're going to spend 2 weeks reading it. I was told this last week, which is a bit embarrassing now that I'm going to actually teach this, that Micah Tinkham, who teaches at Stillwater Christian Academy, has been teaching this to his seniors for the last, like, 12 years. Is that right? So he knows this way better than I do, and he might end up teaching one of the sessions because I just found that out. It's a huge work. Your children, if they go to Stillwater, or perhaps you have been influenced by it, it's still having a continual effect. It's a pretty cool work. It's a pretty cool thing. And so C.S. Lewis becomes popular. You guys can follow along there in the dates as we kind of progress through this. He starts to write a number of things. One of the things I want to address here is in 1947, he writes Miracles, a preliminary study published. World War II had ended. What happened, if you read the book Miracles, which I suggest we'll go over in this class, he sort of defends the miracles of God and shows how they work and shows the practical implications of them. Again, he's writing to a modern mind who, like Nietzsche and like Hegel, thought that the supernatural wasn't real. And so he's writing Miracles to sort of combat that philosophy. He ends up getting into a debate with in his Socratic club, it was a debate on campus. It was an actual debate. Students came, people were there, reporters were there, and I can't remember her name. I apologize, but she basically is this materialist who starts to argue from a postmodern position, and C.S. Lewis actually is this Christian who has been combating materialism as a worldview. But this is his first major encounter, at least many scholars think it is, with this postmodern idea. The difference between modernity is that science and materialism is all that we have, and they will lead us toward the truth. They will make us a better society. World War II came along and blew that theory out of the water, right? Because we saw what the end game was when it's like, hey, science and if there is no God, we just need to have science, and that's how the human race is going to continue. We saw, no, that's actually not how we continue, because if all we are is just a bunch of biological makeup chemical processes, then we can actually do incredibly cruel things to each other in the name of science, particularly, I don't know, killing 6 million Jews, right? Performing science experiments on them, because they're just material things. They're just a scientific process. So that theory, it gets blown out of the water, and postmodernity starts to come in. This professor that he argues with argues from a postmodern perspective, and actually she argues Miracles, the book Miracles. And C.S. Lewis, by his own account and by all accounts of people who are real C.S. Lewis scholars, believes he lost that debate. And he starts to look at his premises here and go, wait a second, I'm arguing the modern world with somebody who, I'm arguing modernity with somebody who is not really a modern. And all of a sudden it clicks in him that, wait a second, maybe the greatest influence that I can have is not by arguing the modern mind, by arguing the postmodern mind with stories. And if you know anything about postmodernity, it's that the emphasis is on story. It's why there's agencies now about how to brand your story, because that's what appeals to people the most. Many preachers have left preaching from the Bible, and they actually just tell stories, because that's how they think you are going to respond. And in a sense, they're right. We do respond to stories. That's why a lot of people love a good testimony over a good lecture with propositions. That's why you love going to the movies, to hear a good story. And that is a good thing. Stories are good things. And C.S. Lewis knows that, right? And so he starts to come up with his mind, wait a second, what if I use my imagination in something that's imaginative? And so he starts to write a book for children. And this little book for children starts off with these four kids during wartime England. And they enter into this different world. And using his imagination, he grounds those stories in the imaginative. And you get the Chronicles of Narnia. So in many ways, the Chronicles of Narnia are the stories that he's trying to write to a postmodern world. Because he understands that his argumentation in books like Miracles or even Mere Christianity isn't necessarily going to work. I still think they're very good books. I think they're very helpful books. I think we should read them. But the ones that are going to attach to your heart are the stories like the Chronicles of Narnia. Next week, and we got a couple minutes left, and I want to take some questions, if you guys have any questions, if I said anything that is questionable. Next week, we're going to look at the Chronicles of Narnia, and this is what I want you to do. Perhaps you've never read them, or perhaps you've just seen the movies. I want you to come next week with your favorite part of those stories. What's the part that you still remember when you were a kid and you read them, or when you were reading them to your kids? And I remember my mom was like reading the part about, one of my favorite parts, about Eustace, who's this dragon, he becomes this dragon, and Aslan, who's a metaphor for Jesus, sort of starts to peel off. He tries to get his scaly skin off and he can't. And he starts to, Aslan comes with his big lion claw and cuts the scales off of Eustace. And the boy comes out of Eustace. He becomes human again after having this nasty dragon scaly skin. And of course, this is a metaphor for what God does to us. And I remember, I don't know if my mom will listen to this recording, but I remember my mom like crying to us reading it. I'm like, oh, why? Because you know when you're a kid and you cry, it's like, what are you sad about, Mom? And she's like, I'm just so happy. And I just like, that's like an image that like, I was laughing, you know, as a sensitive boy. You know, I thought it was silly, but it stuck with me. It did stick with me. And of course, years later, as I read that, it's like, oh, wow, that's an image that sticks with me. That's a story that grabs my heart, that gives me a better understanding of what God really does. It's an imagination that's grounded in the imaginative. So next week, I want you guys to come, and we'll just kind of go, you know, because we have time, to go around the entire room. No, we'll, some people can raise their hands and say, this is the thing that stuck with me from those stories. We'll start off like that, because they're beautiful stories, they're good stories, and maybe yours is the dragon one, I don't know. Okay, we got 5 minutes left. Is there any questions or things that I got wrong? I am up for that, yeah. Yeah. So there are bad stories. There are just bad stories. Like, there is just bad art. It's not entirely subjective. There is just bad things out there, right? Like I know that we tend to look at stories and art as subjective, and it's like, well, if you like it, that's cool. You like that movie and I didn't like movie. Actually, the reality is that there is bad stories. There are bad movies. There are bad shows. Shows that don't point us towards something greater. They just leave you hanging. And what, or tear you down. What C.S. Lewis will say is, those things are just, they're just pointing, if it's good, if it points to something greater. If it doesn't, then it's, then all you have is it. And that will actually leave you bankrupt. It'll leave you never satisfied, and it gives you no joy. Yeah. Yeah, so the philosopher Charles Taylor, thank you, uses the word social imagination. So it's what as a society we think, yeah, that's totally, yeah, of course that's the case. The social imagination right now is whatever your deepest intuition is must be the right thing. We see that in the sexual revolution that we've had. We see that in a number of different things. It's that, and so that's a modern concept, that's a postmodern concept, but it's definitely grounded in modernity. C.S. Lewis actually said, he didn't read many new things. He didn't really engage in a lot of new things. He actually called himself a dinosaur. And he said, if you don't like that, then call me a fossil. You know, I mean, it's he actually believed that the past had the greater answers because they did not live in a godless philosophy or society like we generally do today. Like we generally do today. And actually, he made the remark, maybe you've heard this, that a lot of us have chronological snobbery. And that we look in the people in the past and go, look at those simpletons. They believed that dragons existed in the woods and that ogres were about to get you and that these things existed. And he actually said they had more faith because they knew that he actually said they had a better understanding of their own frailty than we do now. And that's actually why he found stories such a good tool to point toward something greater. But that medium can be used for ill. I use this example and we'll end because we gotta worship the Lord here and I gotta preach. Moana. I've said this before, to you before. I know I've sent it to the high school group. It's a fun movie, but it's interesting because the song that the grandma sings to the daughter is this. She says, pay mind to what your father says, but always follow the voice inside you. That's the thing that will guide you. I'm paraphrasing here. Look it up, right? Don't let that thing... Mind what your father says. But really what matters, the thing that drives you, is what's in your deepest intuition. That is a bad story. And it's a story that won't lead to joy. Because actually, the Christian message is that this story that we have... There's no way that Hamlet could have known who Shakespeare was unless Shakespeare wrote himself into the play. And that's what we have with the gospel. We actually can know our story because he makes all stories true. Okay, there's so much more I could say. I'm sorry, but we got 14 minutes until worship service, and I think we're supposed to end now. Is that correct? Okay. We'll see you guys next week. We'll continue on this theme. Make sure, and if you have the chance, review the entire Chronicles of Narnia, or at least the section that you enjoy. Let me pray for us. Father, bless us as we go. Thank you for this time together. I pray that we would enter into your worship service with joy in our hearts for what you have done, what you are doing, and what you will do. Amen.